This is Startups with Recipes, episode 86. Welcome to Startups with Recipes, the podcast to help developers, designers, and entrepreneurs be awesome at launching software products, whether you've built your first product or you're just thinking about it. I'm Mike.
And I'm Rob.
And we're here to share our experiences to help you avoid the same mistakes we've made. So what's going on this week, Rob?
Well, I was down in Los Angeles hanging out with some friends, and I managed to hook up with Jason Roberts, who lives in Pasadena. Jason Roberts is a co-host of TechZing. My wife and our two kids went over to his house, and his wife Sandy cooked us some burgers, and we just had a really good time. It was cool to meet his family. You know, you hear about him on the podcast. Yeah, they're just like he describes. They're all blonde. They look Swedish. But we had a really good time. So thanks to Jason and Sandy for hosting us. And we got to just, it's so good, you know, to sit down and just talk tech. And we talked startups and we talked podcasts. We talked behind the scenes stuff. You just get into a lot of meaty stuff sitting around the pool, drinking a glass of wine and watching the kids.
Did his wife get in on that discussion?
She and my wife actually did. And they started talking about how neither of them listened to our podcasts. And then Sandy joked and said, you know, we should record a podcast about what it's like to be married to a startup founder. And we're actually looking at putting something together like that. And I think it'd be really interesting for Jason to interview the two wives or perhaps my wife to interview them as a couple to find out the dynamic. So anyways, we're talking about doing something like that. Just about kind of how to have a family and keep sane and try to launch your startup. I think there's a lot that could be learned from hearing other people's experiences.
I think I remember Scott Hanselman, I think he had his wife on at one point, and they were talking about either possibly writing a book or actually they were in the process of doing it and putting something together that was along the same lines. But I definitely recall something from the Hanselman's podcast about that.
Cool. Yeah, I know he's had his wife on a couple times, but I didn't know they were writing a book.
Yeah, I could be misremembering that.
How about you? What's going on?
I'm in Ohio right now, Columbus. I got a free room upgrade for Father's Day, so I'm in a king-size suite. Kind of spent some time with the kids by the pool and got a pool cover for the pool, which I didn't think it would make that much of a difference, but it adds about 10 degrees to the pool. It's in the mid-80s.
Yeah. At some point, it gets too hot. When it gets to be about one, it'll get up into the one, like 109, 110 in Fresno for a few days during the summer, and the pool gets too hot to swim in. Like, it feels like a hot tub. Not that it burns you, it's just not refreshing at all. Well, hey, we have some new iTunes reviews just in the past few days. Some really good ones, actually. One is from Rich Hart. He says, great advice and cut Audit Shark loose. people are starting to make comments in the iTunes reviews, which I think is funny. He says, Mike and Rob, I absolutely enjoy your weekly podcast. It's always timely, relevant, and informative. Since I've started listening, I've created an internet business, cut my teeth with using VAs, and find myself pushing every day to make something happen. And then he comments, he says he thinks it's time for you to let Audit Shark into the wild. We also got a great comment from Zach, and he says, the art of enlightening others. I have to say, I've learned more from these guys than I ever learned in business school. It just goes to show there's no substitute for experience. Thanks, Rob and Mike. And then I like his comment. He talks about how we commented on needing a conference coordinator for MicroConf next year. And he says, I disagree. What you need is a franchise. So we're going to become McDonald's. He says, you've already built the model. Why not spread the love? Imagine hundreds of mini MicroConfs across the country managed by local micropreneurs. The mini MicroConfs would remain small, personal, and retaining the value points expressed by past attendees. Anyways, interesting suggestion. Don't think we have any plans to do that right now. That would be more like franchising it into almost a meetup group. So, I mean, Lean Startup certainly has experienced a lot of success with that. I think, aren't there several hundred Lean Startup groups around the world?
Yeah, I think so. You know, micropreneur meetup groups is really any difference. It's just there's a huge difference between having a full-blown conference versus something local where people get together on probably a more regular basis.
Right.
But you and I have talked about putting on something even smaller than MicroConf, and just the level of effort, it's just hard.
Right. It's hard to justify it, right? If you just do a regional conference, you can't get the same level of speakers. You can't get the same level of attendees. If you try to do a one day, people won't come in from further away than, you know, a few hours drive. And you kind of lose a lot of what we consider to be the magic of MicroConf. With that said, there are several meetups. I mean, I'd say I've probably been contacted by 6 or 8 people who say they're basically doing like micropreneur meetups. And there's one in Australia that we've already mentioned. There's several kind of in the Midwest and a few on the East Coast. So there are things springing up. Yeah, maybe long term, we figure out a way to better help facilitate that.
I've been to a couple on the East Coast, but usually it's more me kind of organizing it or saying, hey, I'm going to be in this area for the next week or 2 weeks or whatever, and then people kind of reach out and 3, 4, 5 people want to get together, then we just go out someplace and have dinner or something like that.
Right. And the meetups I'm talking about are more like accountability meetups. And sometimes they'll get a speaker to come in for, they'll share knowledge that one of them maybe discovered over the past few weeks. I've actually done some video Q&A with a couple of them as well, where they'll just Skype me in and then we'll have like a 30-minute thing and they'll talk about their projects and we just chat about it. Any updates from you this week?
Well, I had an interesting discussion with Patrick McKenzie this past week about Audit Shark pricing. One of the things that he's been doing lately is he set up this training area of his website, and I signed up for it just because I like hearing the sorts of things that he talks about. The first one was a video that talked about how to make your first product experience awesome, and then he followed it up with, I think it was called the Black Arts of SaaS Pricing, which was pretty interesting, and it's kind of timely because I'm looking at pricing for Audit Shark right now. So I emailed him and just said, hey, this is what I'm doing. What do you think of it? And he had some interesting takes on it. His idea was actually to, instead of doing like a per server pricing for AutoShark, essentially use different levels. So at, you know, maybe the first level, say he was just throwing numbers out there, but say $50 a month for up to 5 servers, and then up to $500 a month for 25 servers, and then I think the next level was 50 servers for $500, and then 500 servers for $5,000. Then above that, contact us for enterprise pricing.
Are those the specific tiers he laid out?
Yeah, those are the tiers that he laid out, which I found interesting because of the numbers. And I was like, well, it seems to me like one server and $50 would probably be more appropriate than, you know, 5 and 50. But I was also looking at that thinking to myself, well, if you do one and $50, it doesn't give you a lot of leeway to do some of the techniques that he kind of outlined, which was if you change your pricing tiers and then measure kind of the before and after conversion rates, and you also calculate the profit margins from each of those, it allows you to change the numbers on the page without changing the actual prices. Mm-hmm. I found that interesting. I didn't realize it until after the fact, but obviously I said, you know, you don't need to reply to this. And these are just kind of my internal thoughts. But then I started to get into to think about that. And I was like, oh, that makes sense. You can just change those numbers without changing the pricing, because obviously changing the pricing on your page is kind of a big deal. But if you just change the features that you're associating with each of those pricing levels, it's not nearly as big a deal.
Absolutely. With Hittail, just within the last month, that was about a month ago, based on some advice and discussion in one of my masterminds, some guys said, you know, you should raise your pricing. We kind of just discussed how to do that. And what I did was I kept my pricing the same and I lowered the number of visits that each tier gets. It is the same pricing, just like you're talking about. That's resulted in zero change in conversion rate, which is awesome because it means that I'm essentially making more money, right? Because I've essentially raised my pricing because as people are signing up, you know, they're being upgraded into higher tiers. I can totally see that. I'd never thought about the advantage of having that when you're split testing pricing, but it's definitely a good tip to have. So I'm intrigued. I've actually been given this quite a bit of thought because there's been several apps that I've been kind of working with some entrepreneurs, and they're looking at having that strict per seat pricing that you and I have discussed. You know, you've always kind of had that number per month, per server, per seat for Audit Shark, and we've batted that around. Even over the past week, I thought about like the advantage of tiers and that you can essentially segment customers. So it's not just this linear escalation of pricing that as they add one more server, you know, they only add $10 a month, but they actually have to jump up a tier in essence, right? And now as soon as they go to 11 or they go to 16, they kind of go over your tier, then they do have to make a substantial jump. And that's how most apps work now, right? That's how SaaS apps work. I mean, if you look at, you know, Basecamp or Hi-Rise or any of these, it's not a per user cost. It actually doubles. I mean, the rule of thumb I've always used is you pick a price and then you double it and you give them more than twice the amount of stuff they get at the lower plan. And so his pricing, though, it sounds like he was doing 10x. He had 50, 500, and 5,000. That's typically a broader range than I do. I mean, I would think of $49.99, you know, $199, but
it was 5 servers for $50, 20 servers plus some sweetener for $500, 200 servers for $5,000, and then 200 plus was call. That's what it was. It wasn't 550, 500. It was, the point I was kind of getting at was at the very low end, it was not one server, it was 5. And that was kind of the starting point. he said that the idea was that if you have 10 servers, you're likely a very, very different business from somebody who has only two, you know, regardless of whether they're high value servers or low value servers. You know, somebody with 10 servers has what he likes to refer to as a metric ton of money. Mm-hmm. And he said it doesn't really make sense to charge linearly from 1 to 10 in his estimation.
Then that totally makes sense. And that's why there's a couple guys that, I've been talking to, and I've recommended they do tiering as well. And I think I've always looked back at the Fogbugs model. I'm realizing that I'm not a fan of that model, and I see a lot of disadvantages to doing it that way.
I think that with Fogbugs, once you get past a certain point, it actually becomes much, much less expensive. So, for example, I'm looking at their pricing now. From 24 to 150 users, they have a tier, which is $5.99 a month or $7.19 a month for both Fogbugs and Kiln. And then the next level up is 151 to 1,000 users. And that one is $1,199 per month for both Fogbugs and Kiln.
So oh, that's insanely cheap.
Yeah, I know it is. I find that interesting that they kind of go to that at the higher end, and they're not charging exponentially more.
Yeah, that's tough. That's a tough sale for me. They either know something about their numbers that we don't, or they're leaving money on the table with that. I wouldn't discount stuff that much at the high end, because like Patrick says, and I mean, this has been very obvious in every business I've ever had, the people who are at the higher end tend to have more money to spend. And in general, you can't just charge them more per seat, right? You can't charge the little guy less per user, and then as you go up, you actually charge more. I mean, you do have to give some kind of discount, but it's a huge mistake, in my opinion, to have an enterprise plan where 80% discount or something, you know, if you have 1,000 users. If that's the way everyone does it and your competition does it and that's how you have to price it, then that's fine. And that may be the case here, but I've never had a business where as it gets to the high end, I give substantial discounts.
Yeah, what I find really odd is that it's $30 a month for both Fogbugs and Kiln. And then if you just kind of extrapolate that and you say, well, for 100 users, it would be $3,000 a month. But on their pricing tier, that's unlimited. And in fact, their low-end tier goes from 24 to 150 people, and that's only $700 a month.
So they give a really big price break as you go up.
Yeah. When you start getting into enterprises, they expect a 50% discount. You know, right. That's what they expect.
And I bet Fogbug's competition, which is what it's like Atlassian and a few others, I bet they do the same thing. And I bet this is more of a competitive move. If you publish pricing on the web, you're going to have to be competing with those folks. Whereas if you have a product that doesn't have a direct competitor, then it's a lot harder to do that.
Yeah, I think Atlassian specifically targets enterprise customers with their pricing.
So yeah, they do.
Theirs is considerably different, but it also requires considerably more resources in order to run it.
Right. Okay, so no final notice on your pricing, but it sounds like you're working on it.
Yeah, I'm working on it. I'm definitely going to move towards some sort of a tiered pricing model. I'm having my designer rework my sales page, my pricing page a little bit so that it's got four different levels there instead of three. And as somebody pointed out to me when they were kind of reviewing the pricing page, was that I had green check marks and red X's next to some of the different sets of features. And they're like, that looks like a warning flag to me of, oh, don't choose this because of this.
Right.
Which I found interesting. So I had to talk to the designer already and said, look, you got to remove those red X's, and they have to be like grayed out X's instead. So.
Right. But once you get started with your pricing stuff, I would guess that the first 10, 20 customers you have, you're going to be negotiating pricing, and you're going to be trying to figure out what works for them. And then you're going to learn more as you go. I mean, the bottom line is when you're starting out, you just have no idea what people are willing to pay. You can ask them all you want and make a best guess at it. But we've known several founders who, go into it and the first 20, 30 customers all get different pricing based on how they're able to pay.
Right. Yeah. And we'll probably do the same sort of thing when I launch Audit Shark. I mean, I'm going to go to the people and, I probably won't specifically publish pricing out there. I mean, I'm going to go to my list and start talking to people individually and start signing them on. They'll probably all have different pricing until they get in and start using the product. And then I can get feedback from them to say, now that you've seen it, is this worth what you're paying?
That's the thing. Yep. You have to figure out if you're providing the value that, because you can convince someone with marketing to charge them, a lot higher than you otherwise could. But then when they get in there, if your churn rate's really high because they're like, this isn't worth it, then you need to adjust pretty quickly. And it's such a heavy learning experience the first several months you have an app out, because it's just so young and you're trying to figure out which way to go with it to provide the most value for them.
Right. And I think you can definitely shortchange yourself in many ways on that, on some of the pricing. I mean, you can say, oh, well, yeah, I'm only going to charge you $10 a month when you should really be charging them $100. And they're getting $100 worth of value out of it.
Right. And but I think the thing is early on, like when you only have 10 or 20 customers, some people are going to get in and they're going to get, you know, a lot more value. You're going to undercharge them, bottom line. And mm-hmm. you just have to do that and grandfather them in and move on. I mean, that's just the way it goes, right? Because you're not going to, this app is not going to have 10 or 20 customers. You're hoping to have hundreds, if not thousands of them. And so if you're really mucking around with pricing early on, which you should be to figure out the optimal, you're going to make some mistakes both high and low as you go forward. And so I don't think, you know, if someone's paying $10 a month and they really are getting $100 worth of value, well, good for them. Thanks for being a charter customer.
Thanks for the feedback. I mean, that's what absolutely. You're doing is you're basically paying for them in a way for their feedback. I mean, sure, they're giving you money, but, you know, feedback.
Right, right. I don't believe in large betas. I believe in very small betas, and you can give discounts to beta people. I wouldn't use that as a reason to kind of undercharge everyone. You know what I'm saying? I mean, I might bring in a handful of people, four or five, and give them a discount. But I think beyond that, you really got to start getting to where people are basically getting the value out of it that they're paying.
Right.
So I got an email this week from Tope. He's a longtime Micropreneur Academy member, and he's a founder of App Design Vault. And this is a great email. He says, just got an email from AppSumo today, and it made my day. Hittail was featured alongside my product, App Design Vault. And then he took a screenshot of it and attached it. I'm a lifetime Academy member, and a lot of what I learned went into the marketing and the DNA of App Design Vault. I quit my job 7 months ago, and I'm making a full-time living from the business. So definitely seeing your product and mine in the same context is a good thing to see. Thanks for all your help on the podcast and in the Academy. Thanks, Tope. So this is just, it's another one of those success stories. Like, this is the stuff I love hearing, right? This is why we're doing the podcast. This is why we started the Academy. Frankly, App Design Vault kicks ass. I've always loved this idea. It's basically iPhone app design templates. And he's got a great call to action on the homepage. If you're an iPhone app designer, it's a no-brainer. He says, give me your name and your email. I'm going to send you an app design worth $70 to your inbox just for doing this. And then, you know, he says, join over 2,000 users who are making their apps rock. And it's just a big gallery of all kinds of different iPhone app design templates. It's such a great market to be in right now, right? Because it's, instead of actually building the apps, you're selling the tools for people to build apps. And since it is such a growth market, everyone's talking about it. There's just a lot of search going on and there's a lot of people talking about it. So I love the niche and he's executed well. So thanks for letting us know, Tope.
Yeah, that's really cool to hear. I mean, I saw the AppSumo email come in as well, and I saw Hittail right next to App Design Vault, and it's pretty cool to see. I mean, it's nice to talk to people, but then to see the social proof, I'll call it. It's very cool.
Yeah, I agree. So yeah, the AppSumo deal is going pretty well. They run their deals for longer now. It's kind of a different setup. They used to just do one day and they would email everybody, but it's like they have the list segmented now. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of several weeks that I have to wait to really, I can see daily updates, but it's like not this big massive traffic like it used to be. It used to basically be on email support all day for 8 hours because you get so many questions because their list is like 600,000-700,000 people. So when they email out to it, you know, it's a rush of traffic, but so far it's doing very well. And sales are going well.
Yeah, I hadn't thought about how to manage a list like that, but it does make a lot of sense that they would segment their list like that so that way it totally evens things out a bit. Just kind of space those things out and they level out the traffic a little bit.
Right.
Very cool. I somehow landed an accountability partner for AudioShark this morning.
Sweet. How'd you do that?
I didn't actively try for it. Somebody contacted me through my blog and basically, in a very nice way, said that I'm going to email you, assuming that it's okay with you, I'm going to email you every week until you get AudioShark launched and out the door. So I thought that was really cool. And we had an email exchange back and forth a couple of times. I kind of let him know where I was with AudioShark and what sort of things were going on. I sent him an email link to the temporary sales website that I've been working on just so he could kind of see what it looked like and where things are at. And he said he liked it. He had some good suggestions for it. So I'm going to take some of those into account and rework a couple of different things. One of the things that I got was that I keep hearing from people that they think that I'm waiting until everything is perfect with AudioShark before I launch it. And, you know, people are saying, oh, you got to launch it. You got to launch it. And it's not that I'm holding off until everything is perfect and that, you know, all my I's are dotted and T's are crossed. It's just things are just not ready. I mean, I could give it to somebody right now and it would work and would do what it needs to do. The problem is that back end of it is kind of built around this idea of a set of policies and a library of these control points that you select and you can push down to your machines and pull back results for. But the problem is I don't have that library built, and I don't have a good way to get things into that library. So that's what the tool developers that I've hired are working on right now, is they're working on the tools that will build those control points and build the policies that will then go into the library. So I'm hoping that they'll be done with that within the next 4 or 5 weeks, but the UI is complicated. So, you know, until that stuff is done, though, I can't really move forward with pushing the product out, which sucks in a way, but at the same time, you know, I've also got other things to work on while they're doing that.
Yeah, I think, I mean, to summarize, you built AutoChark yourself for a couple of years. You spent 2 years, it may have been a little more than that, and you were focusing on banks, and you thought that banks were going to be your market. You had an in there, and as it got towards the end, you found out there were a couple things. One, that your customer development, your discussions with banks were misunderstood, right? They were talking about one thing, you interpreted it differently, and when you finally got to it, it turns out you hadn't actually built what they wanted. And B, the sales process was going to be so high touch that you decided you didn't want to go down that road. Now, we can go into all types of discussions about whether, you know, about what you could have done earlier to avoid that and all that stuff, but that's fine. Once you got there, you realized, I can't do this, I'm not going to go forward with this. And so you decided to pivot. And then you were saying, okay, I have this code base that does something and it can help some group of people. Where is that market? And as MicroConf came around, you started asking folks there, and it turns out you're going to be probably pivoting towards servicing people who have web servers and app servers, and you're going to be scanning for like vulnerabilities and that kind of stuff. That takes retooling of your app, right? Bottom line, like you need to then figure out what the new feature set is. You don't have to rewrite the whole app, but you absolutely have to either you or have someone else write some code to now get AutoChark to do what this new market needs.
Yeah, the thing is, there's not a lot of that piece that needs to be done. It's just the fact is that there's this library in the back end that needs to be populated somehow. And the only good way to do it is to manually do it at the database.
So there's work that has to be done, whether it's code or not. Some work has to be done to make it fit this new problem you're trying to solve. You're now trying to re-achieve problem-solution fit, right? Or achieve it, period. So now you're trying to achieve it with this new market, this new group of people, and that is going to take time. You do a lot of consulting. You consult, you know, the most of your full-time hours during the week, and you're also doing the blog and the podcast and doing this other stuff. So it's not as if this is your full-time gig. So the fact that it takes you a couple of months to pivot is not surprising to me, but it does seem like a lot of comments are coming through that are saying, why haven't you launched yet? And while this has been a long process, a 2 or 3 year journey of you figuring this app out, some mistakes were made. At this point, I don't think you can launch. Like, you have to get this stuff done before you do it. And of course, I would love for you to pull a bunch of all-nighters and launch next week, but that's not realistic. If you think Mike should talk to more customers or get into more detail or do more customer development, that's fine. Like, I can deal with that as like a more valid opinion. I just don't think it's reasonable for you to say, all right, you should just launch tomorrow, because the app is actually not done. It doesn't solve the problem that you're trying to solve at this point.
Yeah, that's definitely accurate. There's a couple of tools that need to be built in order for the product to really work in this market. And it's right now, it's just not there.
Our relationship has never really been about like keeping each other accountable with our apps. Like, I don't come to you and say, hey, I need feedback, or I need you to keep me accountable on this. And you haven't either. And that's why the accountability episodes where we really dove into AutoChark were kind of weird, because we don't necessarily have that relationship. We do have a business partnership with MicroConf, the Academy, and the podcast. But aside from that, like, I don't particularly like unsolicited feedback. Let me put it that way. So when people give me unsolicited feedback and they tell me how they think I should run my business or how they think I should develop my product, I don't like it. And I get irritated with those people in general. And so I don't feel like I should sit here and tell you unsolicited, you should do this, that, and this with AutoChark, because it implies that somehow one of us knows better than the other or something like that. Now, if you came and said, Rob, I really want your feedback, which you have, you've actually done that offline several times where after the podcast, you'll show me your sales site and you say, what do you think? But to sit here in a public forum and for one of us to kind of dictate to the other, well, Mike, I think you're doing this wrong and you should do this, that, and this. I just don't know how helpful that is. And you and I don't particularly have that. We just don't have that relationship, right?
Yeah. I mean, you make some good points. I mean, I've gotten some unsolicited feedback from people saying, oh, you should do this and this and this. And I'm looking at that feedback saying, I understand where you're coming from, because I haven't shared all of the information with you, but you're so far off in left field that that's just not even remotely close to accurate. And I don't even know where to start to address how many problems there are with what you just said. So it is hard. And, you know, I try to share as much as I possibly can on the podcast, but I obviously don't share everything. I think this particular episode, we're doing it a lot more just because we're focusing more on, you know, what sort of things we've been working on. But I don't think that everybody wants to hear about Audit Shark every episode or Hittail every episode. I mean, that's not what this podcast is about.
Right. The issues that we discuss here are a lot deeper and a lot more complex than we probably play them out on this podcast. I got a good email I thought was funny. It kind of relates to this topic of maybe someone outside your business thinking they know more, you know, they know what's best for it. I got an email, a guy was canceling Hittail, and he said, thanks for canceling my account. If you guys offered a plan of $4.95 a month that allowed X visitors a month rather than, you know, what you're currently offering, I'll definitely be back. At this certain level, that's when I start to see proper visitors, and feel free to pass this feedback on to your people. I'm sure you'll get a lot more business doing this as well. And so basically he's saying, like, lower your pricing. Funny thing is, I probably get an email like this now, maybe one or two a month from the several hundred people that sign up for trials.
Isn't your lowest plan $10 a month?
It is.
So he's saying that this extra $5 a month is just not worth it?
That's what he's saying, yeah. And it's so hard to make money at $4.95 a month for anything. But the implied message here is that the best price is less than, it's always less than whatever you're charging. The best price is always that, right? I mean, whenever you get these emails. And the second thing is always implied is charging less will always result in loads of customers. And neither of those is accurate, as we've known.
A single support email would totally blow that $4.95 out of the water.
I know. When you are living and breathing and inside something and you know all the numbers and the metrics, I know that I do not want customers at $4.95. Like, it just wouldn't work. It would lower my lifetime value too much. So I will pass, you know, on customers who want to pay $4.95. And if they're able to get value out of it at $9.95 and up, I mean, I have customers paying $100 a month and are very happy with the app. And I want to get a lot more of those.
No, I totally understand and I completely agree. It's so hard to explain to people that they're wrong because they don't have the data, but you don't necessarily want to share the data with everybody either.
Yeah, I didn't want to say explain them that they're wrong. I don't know if it's about right or wrong. I think it's more about how you approach the business, right? It's like if you want to take your business up market and try to make it like more valuable and find the people who are willing to pay the higher end prices, then you go about things a certain way. But if you're trying to go for a freemium product, I mean, that frankly, when I bought it, there were some freemium users and people were saying you should start a free plan and you'll get a bunch of customers. And I've never seen it work with bootstrappers. I can't think of a single bootstrapped company that has ever kept their free plan around. A lot of people launch with it and then they wind up cutting it out. There's that whole why free plans don't work blog post that Ruben did on my blog that was on softwarebyrob.com. It was quite a successful post because he pointed out this fallacy of that we can use the same approach as like a venture funded company trying to do the freemium model. And while freemium can work, it is very, very difficult to pull off. So I think just most people's images of how a product should be launched and the pricing and all that stuff is sorely warped if they haven't actually done it themselves.
Yeah, I considered a free plan for Audit Shark, but I couldn't think of a good way to actually make it work and provide enough value that people would view it as a valuable service, but limited enough such that they would want to upgrade. And I just couldn't come up with anything decent. It's not worth the time and effort, really.
Right. So anyways, I think kind of to close that loop, we were talking about Audit Shark and whether you should be launching right this very minute or whether you are in process of pivoting and that you need a little bit of time to pivot. If there's one thing that I would say, I would like to see you talking to customers, like actually talking to them on Skype or pretty intense email conversations. But before you build something, I would like to make sure that you're building really what they need.
Yeah. At this point, I mean, the product is what it is. I mean, there's not much about the core of it that's going to change. I mean, it can pull back results from a machine, pretty much anything that you want. I think what I really need to find out is what sort of format they're looking for the data to come back. I mean, what underlying problem is it that they're trying to solve? And for the most part, the people that I've talked to have said that they want some level of assurance that somebody's looking over their shoulder and making sure that they're not doing something dumb on their machines. I really feel like there's a big difference between what the small people want versus the big people want. So like the large customers, they basically want to save money because to them, a data breach is obviously a huge deal, but it takes them forever to close the loop on that and notify customers. Whatever the statistic was, it was something like $43 per record lost. So you lose 100,000 records and, you know, there's a couple million dollars in costs associated with that because you've got all these other things that you need to do. And this is more for like losing credit card information. But for a small customer that, you know, let's say that you were using Audit Shark for, you know, your server, what would it cost you if your entire Hittail server was cracked open and hackers stole all the data? I have no idea how to even estimate what that would cost. I mean, I have no idea how many customers, but let's say that it's 1,000 customers for easy math. Mm-hmm. And if, you know, $43 a record, that's, you know, $43,000. Is it realistic to say that that's how much it's going to cost you? I don't know. I'm really not sure when it comes to things that are not credit card related. I mean, you can look at all these studies, but it's very skewed because those much smaller businesses don't report that information. They're not statistically significant, you know, because the regulators don't come down on those small companies. So it's just very hard to translate those larger customers and the fees that they pay for those data losses into the much smaller customers. So I think that the motivations for buying Audit Shark are going to be radically different.
Right. That's what you've started to pinpoint. You asked that question in the survey, kind of why would you need this? What would your pain points be? You're working that into your copy, your marketing materials. And that's where I'm saying, I think that going deeper into those issues and kind of figuring out if there is one or two or maybe three issues that you can kind of segment people into that they're trying to combat and figuring out which one of those to attack first, but keeping it as simple as possible. I mean, it's like, you know, I'm coming back to the Hittail feature I just released with the articles. I started off with this awesome spec and I drew it up like a true developer should, and it was gold plated and had all this logic in it. And I looked at it and said, God, that's going to take a month to build. And then I just threw everything out and I said, I was going to offer three different levels of quality. I was going to offer all these choices of length. I was going to offer there are all these features, you know, with the marketplace, the Rider marketplace I'm working with that I could choose. And I basically just hard coded all of those in the code. And I made one length, one quality level, one price. You click the button to order or not. And as a result, I could totally simplify the UI and the entire integration. And it's, like I said, it's a really minimal feature. Basically, I stripped it down. And I think that's where you're probably headed, or where I hope you're headed, you know, is to figure out what that minimally viable feature set is in order to get those first customers on board.
Yeah, I'm not so worried about the feature set because, like I said, I mean, the product library is what it is. I mean, the product does what it does. I'm not changing that at this point. How I portray it to the user is a little different. I mean, I may need to massage that stuff a little bit. But I mean, at a fundamental level, it tells you whether something's configured properly or not. There's an error message that could pop up as well. Or there's something that comes up and it shows up as purely information. So, you know, like the operating system, it's Windows 2008. Okay, well, that's not right or wrong. It is what it is. And then you've got, you know, you might say, well, is the latest service pack installed? Yes or no? And if it's not, that's a bad thing. If it is, then that's a good thing. You know, so you've got your okays versus not okay results. And then the fourth status that can come out of that is an error. That covers pretty much every single case you could possibly think of for pulling back configuration information.
So I think I've selected my next product idea.
Oh, yeah? What's that?
Yeah. Well, at this point, I'm going to keep it under wraps. The thing is I could literally be 6 to 12 months out from even starting to work on it because I'm trying to stay focused. And I'm dying because, you know, like as entrepreneurs, we totally want to do the next thing because the next thing is way cooler than anything we're working on now. Yeah, right now I'm like focused with an exclamation mark, right? I'm like trying not to wander off the path. Like Hittail, I've just gotten the funnel optimized. I'm starting to market it again after a few months off and things are really starting to take off. They're starting to do well. How about I say it that way? As much as I like this next idea and I think that it could provide value to a lot of people, I don't want to have a bunch of ideas going at once, you know?
Yeah, I talked about it on a previous podcast where I said that me having Audit Shark going and then this Altair's training site, then my forum software is kind of being reworked. And I've actually had sales requests and questions and stuff come in for all three of them in the past week. And it's just, it's a juggling act. It really, in a way, it kind of sucks. You know, it's my own fault for putting myself in this position, but I've had people sign up for the training site and there's things that are just not ready yet. And then I've had people come in and say, hey, can you get the demo up and running for your forum software? I'd really like to see what it looks like specifically so that I don't have to buy it sight unseen. There's all these things going on. And as I said before, my worst fear is that everything's going to kind of come to a head at the same time. And that's starting to happen. So I would definitely hold off.
Yeah, well, and the thing is, I mean, I say, I think I've settled on my idea. I haven't settled on the idea. I've settled on the fact that there may be a need for a certain thing. And what I really need to go do is start talking to people, getting out there, and there really is a need and verifying it and all that. And frankly, I don't have a ton of time to do that right now, and I don't have the focus to do it. I totally could outsource it. Like, I could sketch stuff up and send it to a developer and have them start building it, but I don't think that's the right decision right now. I think that I need to do more research up front to make sure that it's solving a good problem, and I need to basically not be doing either of those things because I really am struggling to fight off the urge to start this product, and I should just stick with Hittail for now.
Yeah, I have several other things that I've thought about, and I've got them in a Google Doc somewhere, and I'm just looking at them. Every once in a while, I'll glance at it and say, man, I'd like to do that, but it's just not now. You know, and I don't think that their market opportunities are going to go away anytime soon, so right. I feel like I've got time.
I am coming up on the one-year anniversary of owning Hittail.
Oh, cool.
Isn't that crazy? Anyways, you had, I think, one more thing you wanted to chat about.
Yeah, actually, do you have like a build server for any of your products?
I used to. I don't at this point.
You don't? Uh-huh. Okay. Because I was wondering how you, right now I'm starting to run into some issues because I've got multiple developers working on, you know, the same code base.
Yep.
So merging code and making sure that check-ins from different people are all working, and it's starting to become kind of a pain in the neck. I did start taking my build server and moving it out, you know, into Rackspace so that I didn't have it hosted locally so that I could do everything out there. And it's one of those things where it's like, I would love to have that build server up and running right now so that it could do all those automated checks and everything else. I just don't have the time.
Do any of your developers have the expertise to, I mean, isn't cruise control, is that still the standard? Because a couple years ago, last time I set it up, that's what I used. And most developers knew how to install, most .NET guys knew how to install that.
Yeah, I'm using Final Builder, so it's a little bit different. You know, I don't know. I might be able to hand that off to one of my guys.
Hand it off, yeah. Obviously, you have to check it and make sure it's done right, but that might be the better solution. You're using source control at this point, right?
Yeah.
Where they're able to merge? Okay, so it's not like they have static copies.
Right. Yeah, I mean, everyone's using Kiln, and you know, they're checking their code in. And the issue that I'm running into is just that, like, certain times, not everything's being checked in, so that it compiles on their machine, but it doesn't necessarily compile for anybody else.
Right.
So that's one of the issues.
That's a big one. Yeah, man. As soon as you ramp up to two developers from one, it is such a big deal, right? It is like a big leap. And then going from two to three is not as big of a leap because you get these processes ironed out.
Right. And that's what I'm trying to figure out is, how do I put these processes in place without actually having to do them?
Yeah. No, I hear you.
So, I mean, part of it's, you know, making sure that the code is good quality and everything else. So I'm going to have to do some of that anyway. I mean, I'm going to have to review the code, which is not that big a deal. It's just making sure that it's all following the rules. So I think that there's FXCOP or something like that. I used to use it to basically make sure that all the code was following specific standards, but I haven't used it in a while. But I always had the issue, it would flag a lot of different things and say, oh, this is wrong or that's wrong. And it's like, no, that's fine. Don't worry about that. And I never really dug into it enough to figure out how to toggle some of those switches. So maybe you're right. Maybe I just hand it off to one of these guys and say, hey, can you, you know, work with the build server and straighten out all this stuff?
Yeah, you could at least give it a shot. So if you have a question or a comment for us, you can email it to us at questions@startupsfortherestofus.com. Our theme music is an excerpt from We're Out of Control by Moot, used under Creative Commons. You should subscribe to this podcast in iTunes. You can search for Startups, or you can go to startupsfortherestofus.com and subscribe via RSS, where you'll also find a full transcript of each episode. Thanks for listening. See you next time.